RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Hello and welcome to RDI Insights. My guest today is the graphic designer John McConnell, one of the key members of Pentagram, who rose to senior partner and became an important part of the development of Pentagram as a global design firm. But as you will hear, his original start at Pentagram in 1974 was a little troubled and almost saw John throwing in the towel. Like several RDIs I have interviewed, John has been badly affected by dyslexia, and his school years in particular were painful, being singled out as not very bright and failing every exam he took. But there was one teacher who recognised where his abilities lie and urged his parents to try to get him into an art school. It became the world he was destined for, and there was no stopping him. He first came to the notice of the design industry in 1969 when he created the logo for the fashion brand Bieber, for which he won his first D&AD award. He set up his offices in the 1960s amidst the bustling fruit and veg market of Covent Garden, where he rubbed shoulders with a group of influential designers that included Derek Birdsall, John Gorham, and David Pocknell. John was an early exponent of collaborating with other designers, and it became a great strength when dealing with large corporate projects. Rather than have an in-house team of design assistants, he much preferred to work with a variety of outside help. It was this approach that became paramount when he became the design and board director at publishers Faber & Faber. From 1968 to 1996, he transformed the publishing house into a brand. It was one of the most high-profile and outstanding projects in the publishing world. And he went on in a similar capacity with Boots, John Lewis, and the British Museum. He left Pentagram in 2005. During his career, he received many awards, including the D&AD President's Award in 1985, an American Art Directors Club Award in 1985, and in 2012, John was named one of the most awarded designers in D&AD's history, and is also a member of Alliance Graphic International. We recorded our conversation remotely with John in London and with me at my home in Dorset. I started by asking John how he would describe the style of his work.
Intelligence. The word intelligent covers a multitude of sins.
I would use the word reductionist.
That's what I call intelligence. Reduce it as much as you can.
I want to also ask you about a word that you have often been rather disparaging about, and that's the word creativity. And I wonder if you could tell me what it is about that word that you find difficult.
Creativity suggests that there's no the intelligent bit is reduced. It's the idea of creativity as being a very hard discipline to make sure it's as clear as possible. Creativity means I can go wild and do anything, and it's creative. The trouble is, be creative and intelligent, you have to be clear what you want to achieve.
I read a quote about it that you made, and you said, usually creativity means showing off to your peer group, and creativity without intelligence is as dumb as it comes.
I stand by that.
What I'd like to do now is I'd like to roll back to your childhood. You were born in Balham in 1939. Your father, Donald, was an accountant, and your mother was a history teacher, I think, in Manchester.
Manchester Grammar School, yeah.
And you had a sister and three brothers. I mean, you were one of the three brothers.
I had a sister who was 10 years older than I, and then I came along, I had two other brothers, yeah, Dick and Tom.
Dick and Tom.
Yeah, and I should marry.
Yeah. You lived in London during the war until you were about seven, and then you then...
You have done your homework, yes, absolutely. My father became ill. My mother decided to move to Kent because her parents ran a village store in Kent, and she felt that she could run something without my father's help.
What happened to your father?
I'm not sure. You're dead right. We moved to Kent to a village shop in a town called Merriwith when I was seven.
And so your memories prior to that, you would have had a little inkling of
the end of the war years or not?
Oh, at the tail end of the war years, my father would tell stories of coming home to Ruislip Manor about, you know, bombs dropping, and people in the Home Guard were showing off about the dents in their helmets, which you suspected were self-made. But I was the tail end of the war. In fact, I think I was born, actually.
The beginning, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely the beginning of it, yeah. So I was a war baby brought up with rationing. That's what my mum, when they went to Merriweth, they felt that she could feed her children without ration books.
You moved to the village where the shop was that you started grocery, was in...
My parents bought, yeah.
Maidstone in Kent, wasn't it?
The village is Merriweth, and it was halfway between Maidstone and Tunbridge.
And what sort of shop was it? Just general store?
General store, absolutely.
Yeah. It reminds me a bit of when I interviewed Michael Foreman. He also, his parents had a corner shop.
Oh, really?
And he was a paper boy. Very similar.
It was a bigger shop and did a big area for orders which were delivered. So I had two vans and two van drivers. And now and again, I would be allowed out with one of the van drivers to help.
And I think you probably did one of your earliest pieces of graphics in that shop, if I'm correct, on a printing press.
My grandfather was a reader, the Kent Messenger.
Oh, right, the newspaper, yeah.
And the newspaper. He gave me a printing press and all the gear with it. So I learnt very on about printing. I did sweet packets for my father in his store. So that was the first graphic job I ever did.
So did you, as a young kid, did you draw a lot? Did you have a sort of creative side to you that you were expressing? Or was that the first iteration working on this printing press?
That would be very early on. And I wasn't drawing particularly, but I used to make models, endlessly making things. Now, buildings. This was all made of balsa wood. So my mother used to take me to Canterbury to see cantilever buildings over the streams in Canterbury. And I became fascinated by architecture and structure. So I would work it out with balsa wood. So that was my form of drawing.
I see. So instead of drawing, you were making. You were making, yeah, making a little structure and working out how cantilevering buildings stood up. Ah, that's something I didn't know.
I've really gone on to do that all my life.
Tell me about school life. Junior school is probably the best place to start rather than infants. So tell me about your time at school.
Well, in retrospect, I'm realising that while we were in London and before we moved to Kent, I was not pressurised in any way. So education was just a thing you did between in the morning and in the afternoon. When I went to Kent, of course, they then realised I was dumb because I was terribly dyslexic.
That's a topic that's come up a lot during these interviews. You'd be shocked. I mean, I'm dyslexic, so I'm very sympathetic.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I am. I know what you mean. You get the word he's thick attached to you.
Yeah. So I, in the village school, which I was sent to in Merriweth, they discovered I was thick or educationally subnormal. My mother, who was a history teacher in Manchester Grammar School, found about IQ. And so she sent me off to IQ lessons. And of course, I was fairly bright at IQ, which didn't impress the local school at all.
Because I think you failed your 11 plus, didn't you?
Oh, I failed every exam going. Everything. 11 plus, the secondary exam, which send you to technical school. I failed every exam. And I ended up in, I think, secondary modern school.
I went to one.
Oh, okay. And to my amazement, I got on very well with the woodwork teacher because I was actually very interested in how woodwork worked. He went to my parents quite privately and said, if ever he has a chance to go to art school, you should take it straight away. So at 14, I went, was interviewed in Maidstone School of Art, and that's when my life changed.
And that teacher was Mr. Hinbest. Well, it's great that actually you find, I think, in people's lives often there is a teacher, someone that recognises something, yeah, you know, and take the trouble to help, and that's an amazing thing. Did you ever get to see Mr. Hinvest again?
I remember him being very proud of an exhibition he put on at school, at secondary modern school, for parents to see. And the pride of place was a table I'd designed, which was dovetail joints. And he was very keen to show my dovetail joints other parents.
So tell me about attending those Saturday morning classes that you went to, where I think secured a full-time course.
I was be sent to Maidstone to the School of Art, Saturday morning classes, and where you learned to draw. And you had a model sitting in front of you, and you sat there and would try and interpret what you saw. The real teaching came much later on. Well, I remember at 14, I was interviewed to go to art school. There was a guy next door to me whose name was Michael Cooper, who eventually became a very serious photographer.
Wasn't he involved with the Stones?
He followed the he followed and did a lot of pictures of the Stones. He came from Bromley. It wasn't a village school. I was impressed how quickly he adopted the glamour of an art school student. He very quickly had a duffel coat and very quickly lived on. Didn't go home. He slept under the local bridges.
Oh my goodness!
And I felt very, very out of touch. Where he seemed so aware and so full of life. And of course, sadly, he took an overdose. Eventually, he experimented too much.
And I gather, on reading your book recently, which you kindly sent me, that during your time when you were stone cutting and doing screen printing and tackling everything from lettering to silverwork, a new tutor arrived called Bill Stobb.
Oh, the principal.
Yeah, and I think he'd been teaching at the London College of Printing and transformed the place. And I think that's when you really started to understand what the possibilities for you were.
Absolutely. Stobbs was the principal brought into Maidstone, and he was before that at London College of Printing, and he brought all his mates with him. And the one that stuck out was Derek Birdsall.
Of course. Yeah. He would stick out.
Yeah. So I suddenly remember Derek very well. And I've been friends with him ever since.
So just tell me about how it transformed your life, that period at Maidstone, when there was a new reign and you were getting exposed to perhaps a lot more interesting things. How did you start to progress? There were two others that were there, I think, that you got in with, and that was George Cayford and Desmond Jeffrey.
Absolutely. Well, George Cayford was a practicing designer. Desmond Jeffrey ran a printing works in Marylebone Lane. I was very keen on Desmond, and I spent a lot of time with him and working at his workshop. He used to fall in love with students quite regularly.
Not allowed anymore.
Absolutely not. He had a Messerschmitt, which is a three-wheeled vehicle.
Oh, I remember those, yes.
Yeah, with a lid. So I would spend afternoons with him driving to where this latest girlfriend lived and being watching outside. And I just remember travelling in this Messerschmitt. But it really was actually understanding the discipline of typography.
You left Maidstone in 1959. You were, around 20 years old. And your first job was advertising agency, yes?
Yeah, Henderson Grossman Limited.
Right, okay.
In Dover Street.
Right. I think you said that wasn't a very nice place to work at. You felt a little alien.
Well, everything I'd learned at art school was not at all interested, or the people who owned the agency were not interested at all. They just simply did things for their client. They were working as best as they could for their what they thought was the right thing for their clients, but I didn't agree with them. So I left quite soon. But what was interesting was that Henderson Grossman Limited were just around the corner from Desmond Jeffrey in Marylebone Lane. They were in Dover Street. So I used to spend more time with him, helping him. He would do catalogues and invites for local galleries.
Ah, right, okay.
That was much more interesting.
I'm sure, yeah, it would be. And so you then suddenly realize that National Service might enter the frame. Because that was really towards the end of National Service, was the tail end of it, really. But you were going to be called up.
Correct. I was going to be called up for 3 years, but National Service had come to an end. So I decided to opt out and go to Ireland. And I went to Ireland for the year until I was 21. And came back on the 1st of January in my 21st year to see whether I was arrested.
Tell me about Ireland, Dublin, I think you were. What did you get up to there?
Oh, I was with an Irish landlady in London. She's had a friend in Grafton Street, the top of Grafton Street, which is very smart. So I went straight into this family, and I got a job with an agency straight away. So I was employed instantly in an Irish agency.
Right, okay. So, I didn't know that.
I've never seen anyone coming from England and looking for a job in Ireland. I was a visualiser, and you visualised ads. You did drawings and showing what the copy line was.
So that would be sort of magic markery sort of thing?
Anything.
Yeah.
Pencil, magic marker. Yeah. But while I was there, my father didn't want me to go to Ireland. He wanted me to... Because my father was a cripple.
Right.
And therefore, he couldn't do National Service. And he felt very sad that I dodged it.
So did that cause tension?
Well, it was tension for a short period.
Right.
And he wrote to me and said the local policeman and someone from the RAF were around to say that if I didn't come back, all hell would break loose. He ran the local post office.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent me another telegram. Later on, said that he'd met the policeman for the village, and he was slightly under the wear of too much beer.
Right.
And he said that he then admitted there was nothing they could do about it. It was all just showing off. My father said, "Son, you do what you want and stay out as long as you like."
You were there, what, 6 months?
A year.
A year, okay.
Yeah.
So you came back, age 21, to London. You joined a company called Tandy Halford & Mills. Tell me about that.
You have done your homework. They were a design company in Dover Street and did packaging. So it was the first time I ever took on a job of designing something from scratch.
And I think you got a flat at that time as well.
In Earl's Court, I had a flat, one room, a bed sitter, I think it was called, that I learned to live on my own.
I think you were living with Michael Cooper and Alan Jones.
That came slightly later on.
Later, okay.
When I got richer,
yeah,
and I could afford a flat, and then I bought a flat in Paulton Square, which is just off King's Road, and Michael Cooper lived in the flat opposite, and he had a very close friend in Alan Jones. So I let Michael Cooper have my flat, and Alan Jones got married and lived over there. Best man at Alan's wedding.
Didn't you meet your future wife, Moira, around that time?
Absolutely. Yeah. Moira lived in just around the corner, so it became much more interesting.
Also, your old friend Desmond Jeffrey, I think, popped up again and suggested that you do some teaching work at Colchester School of Art.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So I was then interested in seeing if I could run my own business. One of the ways to make life possible is by getting a teaching job, which I then visited Colchester. The train rides to Colchester, which is where I met Palazzi, Eduardo Palazzi.
Yes, yes.
He lived in Morden, which is just near Colchester. So I met him and became very friendly with him. One point that we thought of doing a movie together. That was early days in teaching at Colchester. That was much more important to me than the students, I suspect, because I learned more about the business teaching them about discipline and about simplicity and get rid of the word creative and put it in its place.
As we discussed at the beginning.
Correct. I personally learned a great deal teaching other kids the process.
And I think you were pretty successful at getting students into the Royal College.
Yeah,
understood.
Absolutely right.
Which is pretty good, considering it's a difficult place to get in.
Colchester never got anyone into a Royal College. And so suddenly I got three or four kids in a place there.
Then you wholeheartedly started to get involved in freelance work, and you also married around the same time, about 63.
Moira was a fashion artist.
That's right, yes.
From Dundee School of Art. So that was an important period.
And eventually had two children. I mean, Sam and Kate, your
correct
daughter.
Absolutely.
And you were still living in Chelsea then. Yes, is that right?
Correct. In Portland Square.
And something happened. I think Moira was freelancing and basically you got a job from Bieber, which I think she was doing drawings for.
You're dead right. Moira knew Barbara Hulanicki, who was the lady who ran Bieber's. And so she suggested I was a graphic designer and I could do her catalogues for her and did the mark for Bieber.
And that was kind of, I guess, for you, really the beginning of being noticed.
Correct. Absolutely. No question.
Yeah. So that sort of obviously gave you the impetus or confidence to actually rent a studio. And I think you rented a studio in King Street, Covent Garden, at the beginning. I remember this.
I remember this because actually Derek Birdsall was in the same street. And the idea of being in the same street as Derek, he ran a company called Omnific.
Yes, of course, yeah. It became a little enclave of the leading designers at that time because I think the market was closing down and everything was opening up and cheap.
No, that's right, because the market was moving out. So I went there when it was still a market. If you work late at night, you're surrounded by people and all the pubs were open and eventually the market closed down and the pubs were closed. It became very quiet.
I think you were also near Henrietta Street, weren't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you know the publishers are Gallants, the publishers?
Yeah.
This is just an aside really, but did you know that that's where Alfred Hitchcock's penultimate film Frenzy was shot?
Oh, really?
They used the offices of Gallants, or rather the entrance.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's
it's an interesting film. If you see the film, it is exactly as you remember it. You would have been there when that was going on.
It's interesting because actually while I was in Covent Garden in an office which was originally in the business of selling fruit and vegetables, quite big offices, and a publisher moved in upstairs. I'm trying to think of their name. But I did a lot of work for them.
Was that the beginning of your entree into the world of books, really?
I probably was.
I think you moved from one property to another and you were able to rent out some of the spaces that you had rented for yourself. And I think you had quite a number of people that were with you, like John Gorham and Arthur Robbins.
Absolutely. And David Pocknock.
Yes, I remember David. I remember coming to that studio to see you and David would be there. Those were the days.
Because the office I rented was far too big for me. And there was also, I rented a one room to a client called Stephen Austin, who were printers in Herefordshire, who specialised in foreign language printing. I tried to get other people to share the rent with me.
So it was quite a smart thing to do as well. And I remember it was the era of key clamp.
Correct.
And I think we should just describe what that is. It's scaffolding, basically cut down with corner pieces that you could create a table for very little money, but it looked great. Every sort of studio in London started to copy that. Certainly we did. We when I started, we had key clamp. That was the very first thing I made.
Key clamps was an American system. And it was the clamps. It was the joints at the corners. And they were very elegant. They made it in chrome finish.
Around about that time also, we've already mentioned Bieber, but you picked up your first DNA award for that work. Let's move on to this thing that you really became known for, and that was you mastered the art of collaborating with other creative individuals. And I think that a good example of that was Face Photosetting, which is a company that you were involved with, an American company. I think that you started what was to become an annual calendar, which was turned into the most wonderful project for you. And you used to have a kind of rivalry between what you were doing and what John Gorham would do, that you would commission him. And it sort of upped the ante. I think that was, it was sort of based on a repetition of faces, hence the name Facebook.
Correct. Yeah.
But I love that period. And I love what you were both doing. Tell me a little bit about that.
Because in that period, if you were using something graphics, you would have it photographed by a company and they would keep the negative and you would ring them up and say, would you make another print of that negative? And it was a service run by a retailer. It was run by a guy called Derek Robinson. It became a very important part of it because he would also print photographers' negatives, and he became very good at Phil Sayer. People got very, very good at producing their prints. Derek Robinson, he used to deliver to my flat in Portland Square the prints I had ordered. I was then interested in what was happening in America, which was called photo setting. And so I went to the States with Alan Jones, and I had an amazing introduction, because Alan said he just had a phone call from a lady in America who said, was I the Alan Jones who used to play in Ealing Broadway's sand pit? And he admitted he was. And they said, well, when you next come to America, ring me. Now I do research for the Museum of Modern Art. So would you believe we went straight into America in that rarefied atmosphere of the Museum of Modern Art?
And was Alan actually at that time painting?
Oh yes, Alan was. He was recognised in England.
Was he doing that particular style that he went on to become famous for?
Oh yeah.
You know, oh, he was doing it at that time.
Lots of ladies all mixed up. Absolutely. He was famous, and so he went straight into the culture. And I then visited a company called We Should Bring Photo Setting. We Should Bring This Service Back to England. So that's when I started FACE.
That was a very good move. At that time, everyone was still sending their work to typesetters. So you'd mark it up, send it to the typesetter, and it would come back as... And yeah. So this magical thing called... photo setting was just beginning to surface. I remember you used to have to say close spacing, not touching. That was a thing at the time, anyway.
The reason it was called FACE was because you had an enormous number of faces you could choose from, because the original it was a negative. So it was comparatively easy to design a face and have it put on photo setting.
And I think it was really the beginning of your use of wit in graphics, which, you know, you became famous for. Just suddenly deciding that a typeface could also be a face.
Absolutely.
And that made those calendars so funny and special. I think for a while you began to pick up, and as I say, already you were becoming a designer to look out for. You had won awards and you were doing really terrific work. And I think did you not work for a music publisher doing their covers at the time? Was it Music
Correct.
Sales or something like that? I can't remember.
It was called Music Sales.
Yes, that's right.
I've been in touch by an American designer who suggested that the owner rang me. So I worked for him for a spell.
And this again is where you collaborated quite a lot. You were kind of the overarching art director. You would do some covers yourself, and you would get other people to do them. And they were lovely, really beautiful.
I enjoyed working with other people. I learned that from early days in King Street,
of
working with John Gorham and Pocknell. You realised that actually you did better work if you use someone else to bounce against.
I agree with that. I think if you surround yourself with people that are either on the same level or better, it's going to up the ante for everyone. And I've always believed that. It's a great... so many designers are very secretive and...
insular and protective.
Put their arms around their work you know, they just stay the same. But anyway...
That symbol of people surrounding their work and putting their head on it so you can't see it.
Exactly.
It was dumb.
Yeah. so you were doing those covers, and then you did a whole batch of work for Penguin Books at the time with David Pelham, who's a terrific art director, and you got a whole series of wonderful projects to do with him.
I did 60 books for them for a university series.
Which even now, I posted one of them the other day as an example of, because I'm always moaning about what's going on in publishing today, and I put up a series of covers that for me were the epitome of a great piece of design. And the one that you did about Sigmund Freud with his face crossed out because the author particularly was questioning that whole area of was perfect. What you would get these days if that book were published is about half a dozen quotes on the cover.
Yeah.
And that thing would be reduced to some little thing in the corner that you couldn't see. And it would have to read on Amazon. That's what's happened to book covers. Anyway, that's my particular bugbear. Amidst all of this, when you're getting awards for your work, you're collaborating with a lot of great people, you've become a name in the business. Alan Fletcher notices you and pops by to have a conversation with you. So tell me about that conversation.
Okay, he turned up at King Street, Covent Garden. And there was a very smart restaurant round the corner called Covent Garden Restaurant. And he said, halfway through lunch, he said, would I become his assistant? I said, well, I'm flattered as hell, but no, I'd much prefer to be your partner. And of course, I'd learned about partnerships in running FACE.
Yes.
So I knew what a partnership meant. And he finished his lunch and went off and presumably mentioned it to other people, other partners. And so suddenly all the other partners visited me in King Street. Eventually, I was then invited to become a partner. I was very flattered because actually, when I moved to King Street, Pentagram had produced their first book, and it was amazing. Then they had a party to launch Pentagram, and that was a year before I joined. So I was invited to their party.
And you joined, as I gathered, for you, it was a rather depressing start. Could you tell us a little bit about your entree into Pentagram and what it was like at that beginning when obviously all eyes were on you? As I understand it, you were given the task of designing an exhibition for British Rail.
Correct.
And Kenneth Grange and Alan Fletcher made it known that they didn't like what you'd done, even though the client did.
Oh, yeah.
I think you said that you were so demoralized by that you were contemplating throwing in the towel.
Oh, bloody hell.
But it taught you a lesson. It was all about fighting your corner.
I remember that. Because in Pentagram, if you were making a presentation to your client, it was one of the disciplines you had to show it to all your other partners first.
Oh, God.
Which was much more difficult than the client.
Yeah, of course.
They were very critical. And that sadly, Pentagram don't have that exercise anymore. And that I think, is a sad state of affairs. You know, the strength of the word is you learn to get your arguments in line.
And that's a big part of being a designer, isn't it? Being able to advocate, you know, about what you're doing.
Yeah, and you don't have to blush about it. You just simply, well, look, I disagree with you. When I did the exhibition for British Rail, it was about the amalgamation of British Rail, and Kenneth Grange was against it, more than Fletcher. And while I was on the coaches visiting the show, I was mobbed by people who just were fascinated by it. So I was saved by the client.
Well, I mean, obviously, a company like Pentagram, or in fact, any really solid design company, there will be varying degrees of ego that you have to have to jump over. And you always worked with a relatively small team at Pentagram, didn't you? I mean, you didn't have many assistants like so many of them seem to have these days. Well, I think you had Howard Brown, didn't you? He was with you
Howard Brown was with me for a long time.
Yeah.
But I only have had three or four assistants.
That's right. Because you collaborated still, still did that. So we'll go on now to an example of your organisational abilities, and that's Faber and Faber, which was a fantastic project to be given, but no doubt has its own complications. Which tell us how that came about, that job.
Matthew Evans, who was chairman of Faber and Faber, and I, for some reason, I met him and worked with him for a spell, and McCrum was editorial director of Faber and Faber. And I always understood that any organization was that there would be some complicated process inside the organization which everyone would dodge. And I just found it was a better not to dodge it, but to face it out. Because any organization, if it's more than six people, much more complicated than you think it is. So I went in as a design director, and one of the things I did stop was the meetings in the corridor. So the design department would do a design for a jacket, and then the editor would take it round the corridors and get people's approvals or not approval for this cover. And I stopped that and said, no, we have a cover meeting once a week. Each editor would read out the brief aloud in turn in front of all the other editors.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's a bit like your period with Pentagram, having to present your work.
You better stand up. You'd see other editors cringing because they knew it would be their turn to brief a job.
Yeah.
And they would have to stand up in front of themselves, you know, their group. So they become much less critical because they knew they would be in the firing line. And I simply would bring designs to the the cover meeting, and that would be the cover meeting where everyone would agree that was a good solution or a bad solution.
They had an internal design facility there as well, didn't they?
You're dead right. Faber and Faber were famous for having an in-house design department.
With Berthold Warp many years.
He ran it. And the lady left was Shirley Tucker, who I took on. But actually, I really stopped them having much more power. It all went to the meeting where the chairman, Matthew Evans, was there, and the editorial director, Robert Crumb, was there. So in theory, you couldn't get much higher in the organisation than these people at the meeting. And they all had, in balance, I think, of reading a brief out about their book and why this book would be the best thing since sliced bread.
You continued in that role for, I think, 15 years. And then Robert McCrum suffered a massive stroke, didn't he?
He had a terrible heart. He collapsed on his own and he was left there for days. And he still shows terrific signs of that stroke.
I remember he wrote a book about it, and then they produced a play about it as well on the radio.
Absolutely.
So that, without Robert McCrum, it sort of things changed. And you left after 15 years, and I think for a while Pentagram continued producing covers.
Well, but I gave that to a younger partner who then took it on. Yeah.
It changed, didn't it? I mean, I think the amazing thing you did with Faber, being somebody that worked in publishing for 10 years myself and loving book covers, is that you created a brand. It was about the publisher rather than the author. So you'd go into a bookshop and you'd suddenly see...
You start to recognise it. Yeah.
Yeah, it had its own visual language. You could sense, oh, that's a... Even though they had differences, they had the same thought processes over the whole lot. And that's gone completely.
No, absolutely right.
I don't understand why publishers don't feel that they can have the strength to identify themselves in their own personality. I think it's far stronger, but they don't seem to do that anymore.
Are you sure?
Well, maybe in France, maybe in Europe they'll do it, but in America and in the UK, they're all following.
Well, certainly in America, that was the worst pressure came on, which said every book must stand out, and therefore you couldn't build a look round a publisher. And that was, of course, balmy. And where we were successful with the university series, we did 60 books, all the same. And they were set on my Olivetti typewriter.
No, they are a very special series. And when you look at those, even now, as I said earlier, they still work perfectly, as so many covers by not just you, but many others during the early David Pelham period, where the ideas were just fantastic. And when you look at them still today, you think, oh, God, you know, why do we not have these simple idea-based covers anymore that really are intriguing? They make you laugh. They make you smile.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's Faber and Faber goes. But by this time, you've got lots of other things going on.
Other clients going
out. You know, big clients that you're dealing with, John Lewis, and you've got Boots that you're masterminding as well. I mean, it's far too many things to kind of go into detail, but you continued with your ability to be the overall sort of design director of an organization and bring others in.
I learned very often that in the 60s, it was very smart to have your own in-house design department. And therefore, when you knocked at the front door of a client, the in-house design department were instantly against you. They were
you're the enemy.
Enemies. And of course, I realised that actually that was dumb. And usually, what happened was that as I got involved in advising John Lewis and Boots, because they had in-house design department. But usually, it was run by someone who was inadequate in the organisation to do the job. It was someone in sales who did what they enjoyed their choice of wallpaper.
Yes.
the wrong people chasing, trying to administer. So most of the in-house design groups were badly organised and badly run. And so what I did was try to change that, have someone who could argue the corner of the design department in a way which made sense commercially.
And you supplied a lot of work to a lot of design groups, including Carol Dempsey and Thirkell, during your time at Boot.
And I was delighted. These people would do that job perfectly for you, much better than in-house design department.
We're coming to the end of your Pentagram period, because you left Pentagram in 2005. And I think you would go back to Pentagram to use maybe offices, you know, meeting rooms or something, on your bike, on your old baker's bike.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think eventually you sort of, I think the way it works in Pentagram, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you are all individual companies. You were McConnell Design, but you worked under the auspices of Pentagram, and you shared all of the facilities and the building and so forth, and that's
correct.
And you were all partners in that. But you finally left, and I think, sadly, not long after your wife sadly had a stroke.
Correct.
And died.
Yeah.
And then a little later, you had a stroke and was incapacitated for a while. And anyway, you carry on. And I think the British Museum became quite a big client for you.
Absolutely. Again, an in-house design department run by the wrong person.
And are you still advising them? Are you still?
Well, as a courtesy, they send me everything they do, and I don't go in anymore.
Right.
But I ring them up and say, oh, that was terrific. Good example, or that was a bad example.
How is your world working now? I know that you have recently had this fall, and you're recovering from that, thank goodness. But you're still planning to continue to work? You've got things, or are you just winding down?
I'm winding down. There's still things I did, which is shaking the ground under me. The big thing, of course, is...
I mean, I'll explain. You did this fantastic logo a long time ago, which is about Napoli, and you used the word Napoli, and it was fragmented, broken.
Correct.
So it's kind of suddenly reappeared. Tell us about that. What's happened?
Fletcher went to Napoli, and the lady who ran the Napoli Foundation obviously was very taken by Alan. They decided to do an exhibition. Then it was a group who was formed in Paris, an international group, who would do posters for them. And I did a poster for them. And then I was contacted a year ago and said that the poster I'd done had been pinched. I'd lost my copyright, which was not directly true, because the people who pinched it then did enormous versions of my poster. So the image was on my poster was, let's say, 3 feet across. They then blew up to 10 foot across, and they cut all the letters out and stenciled them. And it apparently appeared 50 times in Napoli. I was actually very flattered, because every time they did one of my posters, they always gave me a credit. So my copyright was never taken away. So I'm now struggling to solve the issue with the people who pinched it, trying to achieve. So it goes on, the rumblings of what I started in the 80s.
And what about your personal kind of hobbies? I know you had your lovely workshop, and you showed me that when I visited you a long time ago, that I think was it Brunelleschi, a sort of structure?
Yes, it was Brunelleschi. It was the guy who, the Duomo. He had invented an ox lift.
That's it.
It was his drawings of the ox, his invention of the ox lift. You used oxen to lift heavy loads to the top of the dome.
Amazing.
But he then worked out by reversing the gear mechanism, you could then use the same ox to lower heavy loads down. So the ox lift was worked both ways.
Do you ever venture into that workshop anymore, or is it just very neat and tidy as I remember it being?
It's very neat and tidy. I don't go there much more.
And you used to love doing up houses, or is that still part?
It was always back to Hinves.
Yeah, yeah. How funny.
Interest is still in making things.
Well, look, we've come to the end now, but I wanted to ask you, what advice would you give any young student who's studying graphic design about some pearls of wisdom, the do's and don'ts? What would you advise?
Okay, you should learn as much about your client's problems as you possibly can, because I'm finding that about the Napoli poster. It's because Napoli, I've now discovered through McCrum, was originally a state on its own, and it was a state which was formed about the same time as London. And so at one point, there were two major cities in England, one London and the other one Napoli. Never assume that you know enough about the client to tell them what to do. And you should spend all your energy and much of your intellect that you've got to try and understand the client's problems. Because only if you understand the client's problems can you really solve the problem for them.
That's one piece of advice on these, because I've never had. so few people talk about the clients. They talk about, you know, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. Don't. But the client really is at the center of a graphic designer's world, really. They're the people that put the money on the table.
You bet. If they're going to pay you a fee, the graphic designer is there to help the business.
Yeah.
To help the company. And the company is the guy who pays your bills.
What do you think about the future of graphic design with all of these algorithms now that can literally, you can have logos produced for tuppence, and actually the algorithms are getting so good that some of the things that can be produced in seconds are not bad, which is frightening. I know you don't engage with technology. I know that's not your thing.
I try to avoid it, but it's used as a technique to avoid thinking about it.
Absolutely,
it's a whole technique.
Yeah,
and they can whiz out a quick mark for something, but you really should try to understand your client's problem.
Yeah.
That's what's missing.
Okay, well, we'll leave it at that. John McConnell, thank you very much for sharing your RDI insights with us. That's been really good. So thank you very much. If you've enjoyed this podcast, there are over 50 more featuring royal designers from a wide range of disciplines talking about their life and work. Just type RDI Insights-RSA into your browser and you'll find them.